Hi, and welcome back to Give Us Morg. I'm Neve, and normally I'd be joined by Megan, but Megan's off living a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity in Malta. So for now, it's just my voice you're going to hear, and I hope that's okay. If you'd like, you can follow us on Instagram and on Twitter at Give Us Morg for updates on new episodes and fun quizzes and fun this or that's, because we're super fun. So go check it out. And we'd super love it if you'd subscribe to us on whatever app you're listening to this on. And if you left us a review, that would also be amazing. You don't have to leave us a review, but you know, be super great if you did. And if you do leave us a review, screenshot it, send it to us in a DM on Instagram at giveusmorg, and we'll give you a shout out on the next episode. As a PSA, this episode is pre-recorded, so you will get a shout out though, but just might be the exact next episode. Okay. So today I'm going to talk to you about the toolbox killers. Just as a warning, these guys are disgusting assholes, and yeah, the crimes that they did against women are disgusting. And if that's not your alley, then I'm sorry, you're going to have to turn down a different street. And I don't know what that analogy was, but I hope it worked for you, because it didn't for me. Oopsies. So I'm just going to jump right on in. Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker was born on September 27th, 1940 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His parents were shocked to find out that they were expecting a baby because they didn't want kids. Yikes. Off to a great start. With this, his parents decided to give him up for adoption. Lawrence was adopted by George Bittaker and his wife. George worked in the aviation industry, and so the family would have to move around America a lot. This left Lawrence always feeling like an outsider. Lawrence was then arrested at age 12 for shoplifting, but this was let go because he was only 12. Like, what are they going to do with a 12-year-old? Oh, he shoplifted. Oh no. Like, let's be real, okay? Now, I've personally never shoplifted. However, I do know when you're 12 and you're trying to look cool, like I wasn't cool as a kid. I do know when you're 12 and you're trying to look cool in front of your friends and all that kind of jazz. Many of them shoplift, okay? It's wrong and don't do it, but wouldn't take it personally. At the age of 17, he dropped out of high school in 1957, despite him actually having a really high IQ of 138. His teachers described him as extremely intelligent. Lawrence had no plans to get a job after he dropped out of high school, and he actually just turned to petty theft and other petty crimes and didn't really seem to have any remorse for these crimes that he was committing. In 1957, he was arrested for stealing a car and fleeing the scene of a hit and run. When police eventually caught up to him, he tried to run away, so he was then charged with evading arrest. He was sent to California Youth Authority until he was 19. And he was released in 1959 and discovered that his adoptive family had moved and left him behind. So they abandoned him. What dickheads. I'm sorry, like, what he did wasn't cool and all that jazz. Like, you know, bro, get it together. But they just upped and moved. I never told him while he was in his youth authority facility. Like, what the shit? Like, as if he didn't have mammy and daddy issues before, he's sure as hell gonna have them now. Lawrence then decided to move towards Oklahoma for a fresh start. He was then arrested days later in Louisiana for violating the Interstate Motor Vehicle Theft Act. He was sentenced to 1 year in Oklahoma federal prison. He was released in 1960, and he didn't really find himself a job. He was like, yeah, no, it's pretty fun being a bum. Like, I'm going to continue to do it. So instead, he survived off shoplifting. Lawrence was arrested once again in December 1960 for robbery and was sentenced indefinitely, which meant he could serve anything of a few months up to 15 years in state prison. The prison then had a psychiatric evaluation done on Lawrence. He was shown to be paranoid and borderline psychotic with little control over his impulses. Despite this, he was released in 1963 at the age of 23 after only serving 2 years. However, his freedom did not last long as he was arrested 2 months later for violating his parole. While he was in prison, he was once again evaluated and found to have psychotic tendencies. They prescribed him with medication, but it didn't really help his behaviour. He was then released in 1967 at the age of 27. He was arrested once again a month later for petty theft and another hit and run. He was sentenced to 5 years, but would only end up serving 3. At the age of 29, he was released in April 1970. However, Lawrence was arrested in March 1971 for burglary and a parole violation. He was sentenced indefinitely again, this serving anything from 6 months to 15 years. And he would actually only end up serving 3 years before being released. In 1974, after he took tranquilizers and some alcohol, he went to a supermarket where he attempted to shoplift by putting some steak down his trousers. He was followed out by an employee who tried to stop him from stealing, which resulted in Lawrence stabbing the employee in the car park of the supermarket. The employee thankfully survived. Lawrence was arrested for attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon. He told his psychiatrist he couldn't remember what happened due to the drugs and alcohol that he had been taking, and the psychiatrist, Dr. Ronald Markman, claimed that Lawrence was not psychotic, but that he had antisocial personality disorder. Dr. Markman claimed that Lawrence would not learn to play by the rules, and he was never going to learn by his experiences, and he would just keep butting heads against the barriers of acceptable behaviour. So basically, Dr. Markman is like, this dude is never going to learn, so stop trying to make him learn, because he's not. Which, I mean, like, don't stop trying to make him learn, but, like, stop letting him out after a year or two. Like, and also, imagine getting yourself high as tits and then just stabbing someone because you stupidly were, like, probably in plain sight were shoving steak down your pants. To be honest with you, that employee, like, fair play. I would have just let him keep it at this stage. I remember when I worked in a shop, I witnessed somebody putting a packet of sausages down their trousers. And the moment I saw it, I was like, they can keep them. I don't want those back, okay? I'm not selling them to somebody else. They can keep them. Lawrence was then placed in a mental hospital. The state hospital agreed with Dr. Markman, and they worried that he would only get more angry towards the world and that he would only get worse and more dangerous. In 1978, Lawrence, whilst in state prison, befriended a fellow inmate by the name of Roy Norris, and the two became very close. Roy Lewis Norris was born on February 5th, 1948 in Greeley, Colorado. Roy was born out of wedlock, so his parents quickly married to avoid the social stigma that they would have experienced at the time, which I think sometimes people still experience it, which is wrong, but you know. However, they made it clear that they did not love each other and that they actually resented Roy for forcing them into a loveless marriage. His father worked in a scrapyard and his mother was a stay-at-home housewife, who was a drug addict. This would lead to Roy being placed in and out of foster homes throughout his childhood. He would often be treated poorly by his foster families, some denying him food, clothes and water. Roy also claimed that he was sexually abused while he was in one specific foster home. When he was living with his parents in 1964, at the age of 16, Roy was kicked out of a female family member's home for making inappropriate sexual suggestions towards her and making her feel uncomfortable. Now, this is a family member, okay? So, like, obviously, like, his aunt or cousin or, I don't know, grandmother. And he was kicked out for making them feel uncomfortable. Gross, Roy. Gross. When his parents found out, his father threatened to beat him up to teach him a lesson. Roy then stole his father's car and drove up to the Rocky Mountains. Roy then attempted to commit suicide by injecting air into his bloodstream. He did survive and was found by local police in the woods, and they returned him to his home to his parents. His parents then went into a tirade telling him about how he was a disappointment and how they intended to divorce as soon as Roy and his younger sister were adults. At 17, Roy dropped out of high school and joined the Navy in 1965, which is kind of similar to Lawrence, because Lawrence also dropped out of school. No, instead he took a life of crime. Roy spent most of his time in the Navy in San Diego, California. He was eventually deployed to Vietnam in 1969 for a 4-month period. However, when he returned to San Diego, he was more aggressive and was eventually arrested for attempting to rape a woman in 1969. While he was out on bail, he attempted to break into the home of a different woman, but police arrested him before he could even gain access to the house. Psychiatrists within the Navy assessed Roy and declared that they felt he had severe schizoid personality disorder. With this diagnosis, the Navy just discharged him. Losing his job really affected Roy in a negative way. In May 1970, he began stalking a woman on the San Diego State University campus. As he followed her, he picked up a rock, jumped her from behind, and began hitting her over the head with a rock until she fell to the ground. Roy then got on top of the young girl and began smashing in her face with the rock and smashing her head against the pavement. By some stroke of luck, the woman managed to survive the horrific attack. Roy was arrested for attempted murder and taken to Atascadero State Hospital, a mental hospital for sex offenders. Here, Roy would spend 5 years. He was released in 1975 when the hospital felt that he was no longer a danger to society. 3 months after his release, Roy tried to pick up a girl walking alone on his motorcycle. When she refused the ride, Roy parked his bike and began walking beside her. The young woman, frightened, began to walk a little faster, but Roy caught up to her, so she shoved him in order to get away. Roy grabbed her by the scarf around her neck and tightened it and whispered into her ear that he was going to rape her. Roy dragged her into the woods close by and did so, like the scum that he is. The woman eventually escaped and called the police, but they couldn't do much because she didn't really have that great of a description. A month later, the woman saw Roy's bike parked outside a bar. She recognized it from the night of her attack. She wrote down the number plates and gave it in to the police. And with this information, they were obviously able to link the bike back to Roy. Roy was arrested and charged with the rape. He was sentenced to the California Men's Colony Prison in San Luis Obispo. While here, he met Lauren Spitaker. Roy would sell drugs to other inmates while in prison, and he was only acquainted with Lawrence at first. However, Lawrence was really impressed by Roy. Then, according to Roy, Lawrence saved his life twice in prison in 1978, and the two became best friends. Roy felt like he owed his life to Lawrence, and the two would bond over their love of degrading women and would talk about their sick fantasies. Besties! They would then discuss how they would love to go on a killing spree together and go around torturing young women. Lawrence was eventually released from prison on October 5th, 1978, and went to Los Angeles. He got a job as a mechanic and was earning good money of nearly $1,000 a week. He befriended his neighbours and he tried to blend in as much as he possibly could. Lawrence was described as helpful and caring within his neighbourhood. He was popular with teenagers and young adults because from his motel room at Burbank, he would sell alcohol and drugs and it became a popular hangout spot. This was his permanent residence, so he was living in a motel. He would sell drugs and then like people would just go there to hang out and drink and stuff. So real cool and hip. Roy was then released 3 months later on January 17th, 1979 and moved in with his mother at a local trailer park. Roy got himself a job as an electrician in Compton. Shortly after, to his disbelief, he received a letter from Lawrence asking if the pair could meet up and go for a drive to catch up. In February, only a few weeks after the letter, the pair would meet up and found that they got along really well, even outside the prison walls. Because obviously, when you're in prison, you know, all you've got time for is friends and shit. So was it going to be the same when they get out and have their own separate things going on? And sadly, they did. The pair would meet up on a regular basis at local beaches and would stalk women together. They would take pictures of young girls and would talk about the things that they wanted to do to them. Soon after, no time at all, they decided that they would go pick up a young woman and that they would rape her. Lawrence went out and bought a silver grey 1977 GMC van, which was windowless in the back and had large sliding doors on the side. Easy to abduct someone. Then they nicknamed their van the Murder Mac. Like, what the fuck? Who are you people? This isn't Scooby-Doo. Or he's going to take a quick ad break. And we're back. The pair then decided it was best to do a few test runs before abducting and raping someone for real, as to not get caught. They decided the best course of action was to coax hitchhikers into the van with the promise of weed and alcohol. Between February and June of 1979, they gave about 20 female hitchhikers a lift, not once assaulting them. Lawrence then came across an old abandoned fire road, which was locked near the San Gabriel Mountains. Lawrence broke the original lock and replaced it with one that he had a key to in April of 1979. They then modified the van by putting in plywood bed frames and stored a toolbox and a cooler in the van for them to keep beer in. Then, on June 24th, 1979, they both felt ready to spring into action. The pair abducted 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. They stalked and watched her leave a Presbyterian church meeting at Redondo Beach. It was about 7:45 p.m. and Lucinda was heading towards her grandmother's house. Roy was reportedly the one who spotted her and said, quote, "There's a cute little blonde," end quote. Lawrence drove ahead, pulled up to a driveway of a random home so nobody would see. Lawrence offered Lucinda some weed and alcohol, but she declined. So Roy jumped out of the side door of the van, grabbed her, covering her mouth so she couldn't scream for help, and then threw her in the back of the van. Once Roy was in the van, Lawrence sped off. Roy taped Lucinda's mouth and tied her hands and feet up. Lawrence said that Lucinda, quote, "displayed a magnificent state of self-control," end quote, and talked about how, quote, "she shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. I guess she knew what was coming," end quote. Lawrence drove them up to the fire road at the San Gabriel Mountains. Roy raped Lucinda first, and then they would swap, and Lawrence would rape her. They would send one out for a walk for privacy with Lucinda. The pair then argued about whether or not to kill the young girl. Lawrence would eventually tell police that he got cold feet, and Roy would tell police that he got cold feet about killing her. Roy attempted to strangle Lucinda, but became unsettled by, quote, "the look in her eyes," and then he began vomiting. Lawrence then began strangling the poor girl until her body collapsed to the ground, convulsing. Lawrence then got a coat hanger and used pliers to tighten it around her neck, breaking the skin. The pair then wrapped Lucinda's body up in an old shower curtain and placed her in the back of the van. They then eventually agreed to toss her body over a canyon they came across on the fire road. Lawrence assured Roy that, quote, "animals would eat her," and that, quote, there wouldn't be any evidence. 2 weeks after Lucinda's murder, on July 8th, 1979, the pair drove past 18-year-old Andrea Joy Hall. She was hitchhiking along Pacific Coast Highway when Roy and Lawrence decided to pull over. However, another car pulled in behind them and offered Andrea a lift, which she accepted. Lawrence and Roy then followed the car, thinking that the car wouldn't drive her all of her journey. And eventually they were right. At Redondo Beach, Andrea got out of the car. Roy then hid in the back of the van, thinking Andrea was much more likely to accept a lift from one man than two. And it worked. Andrea accepted Lawrence's offer of a free ride. Lawrence then told her to help herself to a beer in the cooler at the back of the van. As Andrea made her way, Lawrence turned the volume up on the radio, signalling to Roy to jump out. Roy did so, and him and Andrea got into a fight. Roy was able to overpower her and eventually tied her up and gagged her mouth on the plywood bed. They then drove Andrea up to the fire road and once again took turns raping her. Roy then left Lawrence alone with Andrea and went to a close by shop whilst Lawrence tortured poor Andrea. Roy was very nervous about getting caught and he thought he'd seen headlights up the road and told Lawrence to hurry up. Lawrence wanted Andrea to beg for her life and to give him a good reason not to kill her. He made Andrea walk up a hill naked and began taking Polaroid pictures of her, making her pose for him. Andrea has a look of sheer terror, according to Roy, in the pictures. Lawrence eventually got an ice pick and stabbed it in both ears, so violently that the handle broke off, leaving it stuck in one of her ears. He then pushed her body off the embankment into bushes. Lawrence wanted to wait again before killing, as to not alert police. However, the police nor the media were too concerned about the disappearances of the two girls. They had not linked them together and thought that they were just runaways, which was a common thing for police to assume. Then, on September 3rd, 1979, Lawrence and Roy spotted two young girls at a bus stop near Hermosa Beach. Jackie Doris Gillum, 15, and Jacqueline Leah Lamp, 13, were looking for a ride to the beach. Lawrence pulled up beside them and offered them a lift. They accepted. While Lawrence drove, Roy offered the girls a joint and they all began smoking. Lawrence was driving towards the San Gabriel Mountains to the fire road, which was the opposite way the girls wanted to go. And as soon as the girls noticed, they asked for the men to pull over and let them out. However, Lawrence just turned up the volume on the radio, and Roy then pulled out a sock full of dumbbell weights, and he hit Leah Lamb over the head, knocking her out. Jackie naturally began panicking and attempted to open the side door of the van. Lawrence had to pull over and get out and help Roy get control of Jackie. Lawrence bound and gagged Jackie, who was screaming. There was a witness nearby who could hear Jackie in distress. Lawrence just smiled and stated that she was on a bad LSD trip. Lawrence began raping Jackie in the back of the van while Roy tape recorded it in the front of the van once they had gotten to the fire road. They reportedly told Leah Lamb that she was too overweight to be attractive, and then Roy raped Jackie, getting her to pretend to be his cousin. Then, when both men were finished, they tied the girls up in the back of the van and fell asleep beside them for the night. The next day, Lawrence made Leah pose for photos, both clothed and naked. He also got Roy to take photos of him and Jackie, also both clothed and naked. The men held the girls captive for almost 2 days. The two men tortured Jackie, with Lawrence even reportedly stabbing her in the breast. Lawrence then strangled the young girl to death. Leah had tried to escape before Roy hit the young girl with a sledgehammer, killing her. They then threw the bodies of Jackie and Leah over an embankment into the chapel. They decided to once again wait a little while before they attacked anyone else to avoid any suspicion. However, the police were not really investigating the disappearances of Jackie and Leah. They assumed the two girls had what? Run away. Why do they always assume this? Lawrence was starting to get annoyed that the police and the media had not been paying any attention to the missing girls. And like, to be honest, me too, Lawrence. Me too. Lawrence felt that the press should be making a bigger deal over the fact that several young women were missing. He wanted the fame, as he always idolised famous killers like Charles Manson and Ted Bundy. He wanted to be famous like them. On October 31st, 1979, Lawrence and Roy went around San Fernando Valley, which was close to where Lawrence was living. The two men were beginning to feel quite cocky as the police weren't really paying any attention to the missing girls, especially Lawrence. The pair spot Shirley Lynette Ledford, 16. Shirley was trying to hitch her way home from a party. She had recognised Lawrence from the local restaurant that she worked in, that he was also a regular in, and this was why she felt comfortable to accept a lift off him. When she got into the van, Roy offered her a joint, but she declined. Instead of driving to the fire road, Lawrence just pulled over and got into the back of the van and attacked her. tying her up and gagging her. He then told Roy he wanted to rape her while Roy drove. And Roy did so, driving around the city aimlessly. Lawrence put on the tape record as to capture every moment of the rape. He slapped Shirley several times and demanded that she, quote, say something. He wanted to capture Shirley's screams on tape, and when she wouldn't say anything, Lawrence responded with, quote, "What's the matter? Don't you like to scream?" Lawrence then began raping Shirley and made her describe everything happening to her for the tape recorder. Lawrence then began to torture her. He got a pair of pliers and clamped them down on her breasts and nipples as hard as possible. He then began to sodomize her with the pliers, causing massive tearing in her pubic area. Roy later on described her screaming in pain as, quote, "If you ever heard that tape, there is no possible way that you could not be crying or trembling. I doubt you could listen more than a full 60 seconds of it," end quote. Roy and Lawrence then swapped, and Roy began raping Shirley. Roy then picked up a sledgehammer and hit her 25 times in the elbow, shattering the bone. He got a wire coat hanger, and using the pliers, he tightened it around her neck until she eventually suffocated to death. Then, in an attempt to get media's attention, Lawrence decided to throw Shirley's body out of the van into a front lawn. They chose a house at random and then sped off not to be spotted in the area. Which is just disgusting and shows that they clearly have no respect for any of their victims. Well, like, obviously they don't have any respect, but you know what I mean. Like, they just threw her body in a random front lawn. Like, she was nothing, which is absolutely disgusting. The following morning, a jogger running in the area found Shirley's body abandoned in the front lawn of a random home. It had worked. The media were obsessed with the case and it became very public. However, the police didn't really have a lot to work with. Thankfully, they would have a break in the case when Joseph Jackson came into the police station in November. In late November 1979, Roy had been boasting to a friend, Joseph Jackson, about how he and Lawrence had been committing these perfect murders and they had gotten away with it. He also told Joseph about how before they started murdering, they had abducted several girls, raped them and let them go. Joseph had told his lawyer about what had been said to him, and as he was about to go to court, his lawyer advised him to tell the police this information in exchange for a plea deal. He told his local police station, but they didn't really have anything else to arrest Lawrence and Roy on, and this information, at best, was circumstantial. They told him to pass the information on to the Hermosa Police Department, as the details in his information matched up with some of the open cases that they had going on, one of which was the rape of a young woman named Robin Robeck. Robin had been maced and forced into the back of a van where two Caucasian men raped her. Robin sadly didn't have a lot of details for the police, and when Joseph told them about Roy and Lawrence, Hermosa PD sent an officer to the home of Robin with a photo album of suspects, including photos of Roy and Lawrence. Robin picked out the two men in the photo album, stating that she was reasonably sure it was them. Following this, police put surveillance on Roy's movements. When police were watching him, they saw him weighing out weed, so on November 20th, 1979, he was arrested for parole violation. As police were searching Roy's home, Lawrence rang looking for him. The police officer answered the phone, pretending to be one of Roy's friends, and he had answered because he was buying weed off Roy, and Roy was just too busy to pick up. Lawrence didn't buy it for a second and got off the phone as quickly and as calmly as possible. Lawrence then packed as much evidence as he had lying around his house and brought it out to the abandoned area and buried it. Lawrence then packed as much evidence as he had lying around his house and brought it out to an abandoned area and buried it. When Lawrence arrived home from burying his evidence, the police were waiting for him. He was arrested for the rape of Robin Robeck. The police then had Robin come out to the police station and they had Roy and Lawrence partake in a lineup. Robin could not 100% say if it was Lawrence or Roy. Thankfully, police were able to keep Lawrence for parole violations when they had searched his home. Police searched Roy's home and pickup truck and found almost 500 Polaroids of young teenage girls, most of which looked like they had been taken without the knowledge of the girls. They also searched Lawrence's home and found the tape of Shirley Ledford and the toolbox that they used in the van. Shirley's mother had to identify her daughter by her voice on the tape. So that meant, sadly, Shirley's mother had to listen to parts of the tape to know if it was her daughter or not. On November 30th, 1979, Roy's preliminary hearing for the rape of Robin Robeck began. At first, Roy had denied all allegations made against him, including the rapes and murders. However, when police confronted Roy with all of the evidence that they had gathered, Roy spilled in seconds. He squealed like a little canary. Roy told them everything and made it seem that Lawrence was the worst out of the two, and that Lawrence was the mastermind behind everything. He told police all they needed to know and stated that they did it for fun. The police then made an official statement to the public on February 7th, 1980, telling the public that Lawrence and Roy were being charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder. They told the public that the victims had been subjected to, quote, sadistic and barbaric abuse. Roy then took police to the old abandoned fire road where the murders were committed and he told them where to find the bodies. The bodies of Lucinda Schaefer and Andrea Hall were sadly never found. On February 9th, 1980, the bodies of Jackie Gillam and Leah Lamp were found where Roy had described and the ice pick was still embedded in Jackie's ear. Later that February, Roy was officially arrested and charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder and his bail was set for $10,000. Lawrence was officially charged with the same 5 counts of first-degree murder shortly after, but was denied bail. Roy agreed to testify against Lawrence if the district attorney took the death penalty off the table. Smart Cookie knew exactly what he was doing. On March 18, 1980, Roy pleaded guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder, 2 counts of rape and 1 count of robbery. He was sentenced on May 7, 1980 and was sentenced to 45 years in prison with a possibility of parole in 2010. His probation officer described Roy as not having any remorse for his crimes and, quote, can realistically be regarded as an extreme sociopath whose depraved pattern of behaviour is beyond rehabilitation, end quote. On April 24th, 1980, Lawrence was arraigned on 29 counts of kidnapping, rape, sodomy and murder, along with various other charges of criminal conspiracy and possession of a firearm. Lawrence refused to speak at his arraignment, so Judge Willem Hollingsworth entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. Lawrence's trial then began on January 19, 1981. Roy did indeed testify against Lawrence. Roy talked about how the pair became friends in prison and how Lawrence and himself came up with the idea about going around and kidnapping and murdering young women. Roy then went into great detail about each of the murders, making Lawrence out to be the worst of the two. The prosecution then had a neighbour of Lawrence testify about how he one time showed her a Polaroid of Jackie Gillam and said, quote, the girls I get won't talk anymore, end quote. Lawrence's defence team tried to say that Roy acted alone and only confided in Lawrence about what had happened shortly before their arrests. The courtroom then had to listen to the 17-minute long tape recording of Shirley Ledford's rape and torture. Many people inside the courtroom that day were crying while listening to what happened to her. However, Lawrence remained silenced and unfazed. Some even said that Lawrence had a smirk on his face while listening. The trial lasted for 3 weeks, and on February 17, 1981, after 3 days of deliberations, the jury found Lawrence guilty. He was sentenced to death row on March 24, 1981. Lawrence tried to appeal this sentencing, stating he wasn't given a fair trial. This, however, was dismissed, and the Supreme Court found that he was indeed given a fair trial. Lawrence was due to be executed on December 29, 1989, but due to his appeals, it was postponed. Lawrence eventually died of natural causes on December 13, 2019. Roy then died of natural causes in Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility a few weeks later on February 24th, 2020. The chief investigator of the police, Paul Bunyan, sadly committed suicide in December 1987 at the age of 39. In his lengthy suicide note, he mentioned that he wasn't able to cope with the crimes that were committed by Lawrence and Roy. Shirley Ledford's torture tape is still used to this day by the FBI to desensitize new agents to the raw reality of what to expect in their job. And I'm also pretty sure that the jury on Lawrence's trial were given an exemption, like a life exemption, because they had to listen to the horrifying tape. Which, you know, I think is the least they deserve. So that is the case of the Toolbox Killers, Lawrence and Roy, besties till the end, you know, when they got caught. And then Roy was like, it was all Lawrence. Had nothing. What? I was just innocent. I was coerced into it. Yeah, sure you were, Roy. Sure you were. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, make sure you check out some of our previous episodes. Last week I talked about the Irish Vanishing Triangle, which I'm pretty sure was my first Irish case. So if you subscribe to us on whatever you're listening to us on, we would really, really love that. And if you left us a review, that would also be amazing. And if you screenshot the review, you can send it to us on Instagram at giveusmorg, and we'll give you a shout out on the next episode. And as a PSA, this episode is pre-recorded, so it won't be the next episode, but it will be one soon after this. Pinky promise. You can also follow us on Twitter at GiveUsMorg for episode updates and some just other fun, quirky stuff that we do, you know. If you want to follow our own personal Instagrams to see who you're listening to, you can also do so. And they're at Mrs_Neve and at MegPowell_. It's been super fun, you guys. Yeah, that was a really horrible case, and I hope you're not listening to this late at night for editing purposes. And if you're not Megan and you're not editing this, then I hope you enjoyed it, and maybe you enjoy listening to creepy stuff late at night. Who knows? So yeah, okay. See you soon, guys. Bye!